F2A. Number 15B.
So let's go to the next one, to life. And you see again the same stereotyped way. You know, when I started out, that was way back in 1960, I gave for the first time laws. I will talk about it next week, the whole problem about laws and how we need to know laws in Christian Science. But when I first started out giving laws and showing it through the first through the prophets and then through the epistles, I had an enormous resistance. Enormous resistance. Because the general state of the human mind is that it does not want to be bound into a law. That's bondage, they felt. Is the law in mathematics a bondage? Is the law in mechanics a bondage? It's freeing. If you know the laws of mechanics, it's freeing. And we can use those laws in mechanics and can do the best one can do in that realm. So the human mind feels, now let the thought flow the way it likes to flow. And therefore I don't want to have anything stereotyped. This is against the inspiration and the free inspiration and the free flow of thought. That is the real thing. Life is always new. Life is always seeing something exalted, something that is lifting us out of something. And so the human mind likes to be free in that way and not be bound into a law. But the law is that what the whole textbook demands. The whole textbook is full by stating there are laws of God, that there are the laws of the Christ, the laws of Christianity, the laws of science, the laws of principle, the laws of mind, the laws of spirit, the laws of love. We hear all about these laws. Well, if that is the teaching of Christian Science and we take it serious, then we must say, all right, let's have laws. And laws imply that you have a stereotyped language, that you have a stereotyped presentation. We can't just talk about any law in mechanics just in poetic ways. It doesn't matter. That doesn't go. It must state it with symbols that are exact and that there are always the same symbols and the relationship between them must always be definitely the same. So we get to that stereotyped thinking. And you will see that stereotype thinking is freeing us and not binding us into something narrow. That was another side remark of importance. So we have another example. He takes life. Now I take life here. And again we have, when we accept our conscious unity now with life, see, I take another specific in place of the Christ. So that's Roman 1. Then I come to Roman 2. Life manifests itself to us, again the stereotyped rendering, as what? As the all-providing Father. You see now the all-sufficiency in life as the all-sufficient Father, huh? Namely as the all-providing Father. You get the tone of life. Life provides, the Father is providing. And then you come to 3, Romans 3, and invalidates the use of any other. Now must come something that is the very counterfeit of the all-providing Father. What is a counterfeit? It invalidates the use of any other source of substance, maintenance, and provision. Shows that any other source than the source of life, the Father, is actually never sustaining us. It's never really providing us with something real. So if I rely on something else, I know that I will not get life. I can rely on food to live, but that doesn't give me life. That only gives me material life, but not true life. If I rely on money to live with, I don't rely on a life that gives life. It's very tricky. So we have to be sure that if we have to demonstrate the provision of life, that we are not relying ourselves on a material source of provision, but that we start with a spiritual source of provision. That we start by saying, well, if I need supply, and if there is a question of supply in the human, well, I bet I have to work it out, but not in the human. I work it out in the spiritual. I have first to see that law of Galatians, that life, capital L, is the Father of the universe, that Father provides, and what he provides. And see that he only provides ideas, and he only provides life in and of spirit. And I have to see that infinite provision, and that takes care of the human situation, and not the other way around. That I go to the human Father, to a human or material source in order to have supply, and then if I get supply from there, then I say I have a lot of life. So people with a lot of money have not more life than people with no money, because it has nothing to do with life. Life is God. And therefore, it's the all-sufficient provision. Let's take another example. How could you now work further with life here? What shall we take with life? What would you like to take as life? Supply. Well, that's more or less what I had here, huh? Provision and supply, yes.
What about health?
Huh?
Health.
Health is not an idea of life. Being. Okay, let's take being, beingness, huh? So I say, only when we accept our conscious unity with life, capital L, huh, then I know if I'm one with life, God, huh, that has a Christ, and that Christ is the all-sufficient Christ. Therefore, then that life, which is as a capital L, huh, manifests itself in us as being, as spiritual being, as perfect being, as perfect existence, as immortal existence. You can take being as existence or beingness, and so you see, and this would, and we come to Romans 3, and this would invalidate, namely what? That we don't get beingness by relying on what? On matter, on the body, huh? On food, on and everything that seems to have or to give us beingness, huh? That is supporting existence. So that we see, though in the human we need all that, that does not give us being. Therefore, those who have millions and have a lot of food and plenty of food, that they have not life. They have not being. They are not. They don't live. They only exist in the material universe, but they don't live. They don't get more life because they have a lot of money and a lot of food and big houses, etc. So you get being only by seeing that life, that you are one with that life which is God. If I'm consciously conscious of my unity with life that is God, then God dwells in me, then life comes to me as being, as life with a capital L and as life with a small L, both comes to me. And gives me that being which is spiritual, which is perfect, which is eternal, which is immortal. And you can elaborate on being, what being is, huh? Being that is spiritual, being that is sinless, being that is perfect, being that is eternal, that being that is immortal, and so on. You can elaborate even further then. Let's take truth. So, when we accept our conscious unity with truth, see, all this implies prayer. This implies really that inwardly we are conscious that there is only one truth, and that that one truth is then, as the Christ, manifesting itself to us as the all-effective consciousness. That's Romans 2. So I can see, the more I'm one with truth, with the whole realm of truth, and the whole consciousness, the divine consciousness of truth, the more that Christ consciousness works in me effectually. That's truth. I have an all-effective consciousness, and a consciousness that works because it has a Christ within itself. And then you can say, well, then, what does it invalidate? It invalidates, therefore, that which also seems to be effective. So the point is on effectiveness. So it invalidates the use of medical or theological or dogmatic or doctrinal or scholastic so-called truths. I don't have to rely on any other so-called truths. Yes? So only then do I really find the true solution. But the moment I think, yes, God is truth, and that's nice, and that truth is all right, but besides that, I need other truths. I need the truths of mathematics, I need the truths of physics, I need the truths of chemistry, I need the truth of the theologian, I need the truth, I don't know what. These are also truths. They are not truths. They are humanly conceived elements, and therefore all these truths that we have from the other sciences can never lead us into truth. No matter how intelligent they are, it doesn't lead into truth with a capital T. Therefore, they rely that those other sciences give us also truth, and that they also help us to see the truth better, is a mistake. It's a complete mistake. It's only truth that gives us truth, through its Christ. Let's take here another one in truth. What shall you take in truth?
Huh? Revelation.
Revelation? Yes, you can take revelation. Though we had revelation also in principle, but truth, go right. Let's take revelation. That's something which we all like to have. And how do we get it? Revelation is naturally something that has to do with truth in so far as it reveals something more about true being. So the truth of being comes out clear. All right. So how can we get that? Paul would tell the Galatians, look here, you don't have revelation, you have shut up your consciousness, and therefore revelation could not come in. You are a silly old boy. Why don't you do what I told you? I told you to open up your consciousness to the one truth. Therefore, when we accept our conscious unity with truth, with the whole truth, then truth manifests itself to us as what? As true revelation, as divine revelation, as a real revelation, not elusive revelation. And so as a revelation which stands and which is all-sufficient. And you don't have to go to other books and to people and to the priest and to the pope and I don't know to whom in order to have a new revelation. Think of the poor pope, how many revelations he has. All these revelations are to use the airplane. I would give a good pope. I like to travel also. Okay. Yeah. We go to love and see how we elaborate that. So when we accept our conscious unity with love, that's the Roman 1, and comes Roman 2, only then really love manifests itself to us. As what? Now an idea of love. As the all-ministering motherhood. So we have motherhood and we have ministering and serving. These are two terms really, both are ideas of love. Motherhood is love, ministering is love. So we have a feeling that love takes care of us. And so we don't need to rely on something else. And that invalidates, now we come to Romans 3, the reliance on the counterfeit of that all-ministering love, namely on human motherhood, on human planning and designing. That's what mother usually does. And a sense, and a human sense of protection. The love is protecting us, is ministering us, and is mothering us and caring for us. So that's quite enough. We don't need to have any other mothering, because any other mothering is smothering and not mothering. And so we have to build up within our consciousness, really, that even if humanly we long to be mothered by people, sometimes it's quite nice, but it doesn't really bring us anywhere spiritually. That only then when we are relying entirely and consciously that we are one with that motherhood of love which is universal, which is all-inclusive, only then I rely on the all-sufficiency of divine motherhood if I don't try to find it somewhere else. Somewhere else. In a human motherhood, in a human caring. All that is nice, but it doesn't really bring us further. So we have to be very careful that we can say, well, in the human we still like, and it's nice to have some kind of a good human mothering and caring and protecting. That's all very nice, but that doesn't really do the trick. I like to see that in every situation it's actually God that cares for me. No matter if that God then uses people or a circumstance to mother it. That's possible. But fundamentally, I like to see that my mother is God, love, and that everything is in there. I think that's why, perhaps, that I have such a great esteem for my human mother, because she told me right from the beginning that I have no parents, that I'm not born of parents, neither of a father nor of a mother, that I have no ancestry other than God, the Father, Mother, God. And this is something I then not only listened to her, but that's something that I entertained, especially in my years at the university. I entertained during those many years constantly that concept, that I'm not coming from a father, not from a mother. I have no material ancestry. All what I have is that God is my mother, my father, and I have never been born into this world. Never born into this world. I just have to make the demonstration that here and there I don't believe it, that it is so. Yeah, now what can we take? Another idea of love? Let's take plan of love. It's always so important that we see that our life is hid with God in a terrific big plan, and that God works in mysterious ways which we cannot think out. It's above our dreams, above our imagination. It's a big, much bigger thing. So how can that plan of love really be effectually working within us? Only then when we accept the plan of love as the only plan that is working within us. And so what is the law about it? Instead just of stating it would be nice, or it is nice, that if only the plan of love is working in me, I make a law out of it. A law and put it into the categories of being, and not just into terms. So I say, in order to do that, I have first to live in the category of that word, which says, I have to accept consciously my conscious union with that one God, love. I have to start out that. That's a category, you see. That's now no more just stating something. That's a category of the word in Christian Science. So in the way that I accept my conscious unity with love, then love can manifest itself in me. And we said we take the plan, and that love can really manifest itself in me and in all as the universal saving plan of God, as the universal design of God, that design which God has about my life. And He has a design. And so this invalidates that I should support that plan of love with a false sense of plan. Namely, what could we say here? That invalidates that I rely on human planning. Who does not human planning? We all are somehow tempted always to plan something humanly. We plan our life humanly, we plan our day humanly, we plan our mission in this world humanly. See, we have all kinds of plans that are all either human or material or financial, or planning something just doesn't come right into my mind, but we are calculating our plan, ourselves. And therefore we go right against the calculus of the Christ. And therefore we miss always the boat. Yeah. We take the next one, soul. When we accept our conscious unity with soul, what does that mean? I accept that I have that soul, which is also the soul of God. I accept I have no other ego but that ego which is God, that soul. Then, Romans 2, soul manifests itself to us as the all-satisfying testimony. So it doesn't translate itself as the human testimony or the physical testimony. So I take here soul as that which comes to me as a all-satisfying testimony. And therefore this invalidates, now Romans 3, the very opposite of that spiritual testimony, namely trust in mortal, personal, and worldly sense testimony. So if I rely only on soul, soul always comes to me and says, the only thing that satisfies you is the spiritual sense testimony. Don't think that material sense testimony can satisfy you too. It can never satisfy. It can temporarily give us a bit of fun and a bit aesthetical values, but when we come face to face with God, then only that matters what is of the nature of soul. So let's culture within ourselves that spiritual sense that is only satisfying. Or we come to spirit and take that example. When we accept our conscious unity with spirit, then spirit manifests itself to us as what? We have an idea of spirit, namely as the all-transcendent substance. Not as material substance, but as that spiritual substance. And this invalidates, therefore, the belief in a physical or material qualities, or physical and material calculations, or physical and material conditions. That invalidates it. And you see, that's the opposite of the all-transcendent substance. I could have said spiritual substance or divine substance. And that invalidates that I should also rely on the opposite, on physical or material qualities, on physical and material calculations, that's all false substance, or physical and material conditions. You can say, well, isn't that a bit impractical, up on cloud nine? No, it isn't, because we know then afterwards that the Christ takes care of the opposite, so that Christ takes care that we have also enough substance in the material realm, that we have also enough substance as true human qualities, not only spiritual qualities, but also human qualities. Because we can see afterwards, and we go on, that the Christ naturally then translates everything to the human and gives to the human a higher tone. That's then in Philippians. And we come to Philippians, he shows them that. So that this here is not being impractical. Huh? This is not impractical. Because you say, well, after all, here I have to rely on material substance. I need to earn money. I need to feed myself. I can't go on yet without food. But that's not the question, you see. Because that is the outcome of the fact that I do not rely on material substance. It's the outcome of the fact that I rely only on spiritual substance. And that translates itself then in Philippians as bringing me all in the human, what I need to have in the human. So that's the further step. So that would, you see, this argument would really be Galatians, if I would say, yes, that's all right, Mrs. Eddy, you teach us that alone spirit is substance, that matter is not substance. But here and there I need money, and here and there I need food. I just need it, or I die. So I don't like to die, so I want material substance. That's the reasoning of the Galatians, huh? And he says, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Rely that substance is spiritual, that provision is spiritual, and that will take care of you. That's why he afterwards said, well, then there is the law of spirit instead of the law of the works. And that works within you. But that's a further step of development. Yes. Then in mind, we can quickly say that when we accept our conscious unity with mind, then mind manifests itself, now comes an idea of mind, as the all-pervading influence. For instance, here they have taken as mind influence, that there is an all-influence. We see that in animal magnetism then, that mind is the all-influence. And that we should not resort to any other influence, namely to hypnotism, telepathy, mesmerism, animal magnetism, thought transference, occultism, witchcraft, black and white magic. These are all false influences. Can you see that? They are not just wrong systems. They are systems of influencing our life. Well, that is the way every epistle is laid out. And so perhaps when you see that, it makes much more sense when you read my book than before. All right? This afternoon, we start with Ephesians.